Hello, and welcome to New Matter, the SLAS podcast. I'm Mike Tarcelli, and I'm the scientific director for SLAS. Joining me today is Dr. Janice Chen of Mammoth Biosciences, a startup in the Bay Area. How are you doing, Janice?
I'm good. Thanks for having me today.
We are always glad to have you, and especially an illustrious person such as yourself. Tell me, because this is the challenging thing we do, what is your day-to-day work or company life like in 10 words or fewer?
It's a hard question to answer, and I actually thought about it beforehand. What I came up with was new challenges every day that require cross-functional problem solving.
You've answered us very generally. Usually people say computational biologist, RNA, DNA assays. So tell me about this challenge of cross-functional team challenge. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely as we are a small but rapidly growing company, we have a lot of really tall ambitions that we're going after. So there are a number of different programs that we've kicked off, particularly on the diagnostic side, or where we're trying to tackle next generation COVID diagnostics. And so there are a number of complex issues that come up, whether it's technical, managing these programs, managing external expectations and relationships. All of these require a team to help solve and move forward. And it's really fascinating and exciting to have a group of people really dedicated towards the mission of how we can use our technology to develop meaningful solutions for not just the pandemic, but beyond.
So tell me, I think that your actual title is CTO or Chief Technology Officer. Would you say that you are still hands down deep in the science, or that you have a team that sort of helps you with that and you're more herding cats and getting external impressions in, as you've said?
Yeah, it's a good question. So yeah, I'm one of the co-founders as well. So, I've seen the company go from very, very small to where it is today. So we're about 40 full-time employees now. So
I would say,
it's amazing to see the growth and bringing on new talent to the team. So certainly my role has evolved a lot since the early days. Obviously, before even starting the company, I was a graduate student and then pretty much went headfirst in with my colleagues, Lucas Harrington and Trevor Martin, two of the other co-founders, as getting our vision, into reality. And so we have people who are diving in on, the technical issues. I help, bring in and manage these teams that are dedicated to solving specific aspects of different products that we're working on. But certainly I bring in a lot of background on the CRISPR expertise and understanding how these enzymes work and how we can maximally utilize them to actually create diagnostic solutions. But as far as taking technology towards product, we just brought in actually two new executives to help us take that vision to reality as well. So a lot of, awesome people joining the team, people who take it all the way through.
Okay, that leads me into two interesting paths. One, you said you saw it grow from a tiny little idea or a tiny little lab in a startup capacity. So I'd love to hear about the quote unquote early days. Did you spring out of a academic lab format? Did you rent space, et cetera? And then I'm going to ask you a couple questions about hiring, because you mentioned hiring people who are more experienced than you. And I'd love to hear about that challenge and friction that can sometimes occur. So first, let's talk about the startup steeds. What was that like?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of when to start the story, but myself and my former lab mate, Lucas Harrington, we were basically lab mates for the last several years in Jennifer Doudna's lab at Berkeley, and it's been spending a lot of our time understanding CRISPR systems, discovering new ones, developing tools and technologies out of them. And definitely, it was a lot of serendipity as far as uncovering a new activity with these proteins that we recognized could be used as a new method of diagnostics. And so that was kind of the initial spark as far as being able to take these technologies outside of an academic lab, which we had been co-inventors on with some of other colleagues in Jennifer's lab, and actually trying to use them for greater impact and benefit to society. So that was kind of the initial spark as far as the growth from that point. Teamed up with Trevor Martin, CEO, who graduated from Stanford. So, a unique Stanford-Berkeley alliance. We had started
not common.
We started out in a really great incubator space, MBC, located in Dogpatch in San Francisco. So managed to get some space in the lab, get some office space, built out a very small team, really amazing scientists that helped lay the foundation of the technology and the platform. There's a lot of help with advisors along the way, both from our academic scientific advisory board, as well as industry leaders that now some of them serve as folks on our board at Mammoth. And from that point, we were really just getting the groundwork laid. So a lot of working on top of each other in the incubator space. It was a really nice facility, but we very quickly outgrew that. And almost a year ago now, we moved to a new facility here in South San Francisco on Verily's campus. And so it's been definitely a pretty exciting period as far as being able to get, you know, technical milestones hit. We have some public, you know, announcements with deals that we've made on both the diagnostics. So you may have heard of our recent deal with GSK to develop COVID diagnostics. We've also been expanding our CRISPR discovery platform and, you know, utilizing new nucleases for genome editing applications. And so we have a partnership with Horizon Discovery to leverage these new nucleases for CHO cell line editing. And we have many other exciting programs in the pipeline that have not been announced, but we're staying very busy. And I think we're in a very exciting period where CRISPR, frankly, is eating the world, right? There's so many applications that comes out of the technology, and there's great need as we're seeing today. So we're full speed ahead, but, you know, the team is, in the last couple of weeks, we've brought in many new faces, and it's quite amazing to do that during a pandemic as well.
So I have so many questions to ask you based on that last thing, but I would like to hear first, what's it like to be coming out of graduate school, not yet fully launched into a full career, but you have to hire somebody who's maybe 20, 30 years older and been doing this for a lifetime to report to you? What's that like?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a privilege. And I think there is an element of recognizing your own strengths and weaknesses and basically, you know, opening an opportunity and vision and mission for people to be a part of. I think at the end of the day, it's really understanding that there are so many different skills and expertise that's needed to actually, you know, turn a vision into something that's real. And part of that is bringing on people who know more than you, who have more experience. As far as, you know, reporting structure, for me, it's about giving experts enough space to do what they need to do, but making sure that the vision is in line, right? And I think that's where it's very exciting because there's a really amazing two-way learning street, certainly for me as someone who's very early career. But I would say as people who are part of the company and want to drive it forward, understanding kind of where we see the company going, how we want to build the platform, how do we want to use CRISPR for good and new applications is something that I believe is a very exciting opportunity for people who want to come in and help us build this.
That's great and super good answer. Now, touching back upon what you said in the scientific portion, when you talked about the research collaborations ongoing and the directions you're advancing the technology, you mentioned offhand the development of other CRISPR nucleases. And I know that most people listening to this are probably very familiar with CRISPR-Cas9. Some may be very familiar with Cas12. Tell me about other nucleases, because I know you've published a paper recently in the Nature family that has tons of nucleases outlined. Tell me about how you came about finding those and what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one thing to recognize is while most people hear about CRISPR, they think about Cas9, as you mentioned, CRISPR really is a highly diverse system that exists in nature. So, you know, these come from bacteria and archaea that really are their, you know, immune systems for defending against foreign sequences. And so because of where they come from, they have, you know, benefited or frankly, you know, gone under billions of years of evolution to, you know, have new different activities to help bacteria and archaea defend themselves. And so from that perspective, you know, it's important to recognize that it's a very intricate system that involves this nuclease, which does what we call the interference step. And that's what's actually cutting the nucleic acid, whether that's DNA or RNA. But there's also many other Cas proteins involved in what we call a CRISPR locus that perform other functions to allow the whole system to work. But as far as, you know, using these proteins for gene editing, a lot of the focus has been on that nuclease or the interference protein because of its programmable nature. So, you know, Cas9 has certainly made a splash in the gene editing world because it has what's called a guide RNA, which scientists can readily engineer to target the intended sequence. And that kind of fundamental power of the system exists with all these other flavors of CRISPR proteins that have really been, you know, discovered in the last, many of them in the last, you know, 5 or so years. And we continue to look at new environments and, you know, organisms that aren't traditionally cultivated in a laboratory. So this is kind of related to the field of metagenomics and looking again at the raw sequences and identifying, you know, these CRISPR loci that contain new enzymes that we don't know how they work. And so a lot of what my colleague Lucas has been devoted to, and as well as our collaborators at the JGI, also at Berkeley, have been trying to understand, well, how do we actually reconstitute these systems that exist in nature and understand how they work so we can make better tools out of them, whether it's gene editing or diagnostics or others. And so as far as, you know, that's kind of in many ways where this diagnostics field even, you know, started to take a lot of momentum, is we never even realized that there was this capability of, you know, this non-specific cleavage activity that we can use to leverage for a new way of detecting sequences. So that's one very specific example of where the diversity of CRISPR actually opens up new applications. You know, now we've identified even smaller proteins, right? And so you're talking about proteins that are a third of the size of the Cas9 system, which has been very successful for genome editing, but the small size now opens up new capabilities for delivering it into functional enzymes to the nuclease. There's a whole world of things you can do because of the vast diversity of these proteins and what they're capable of. And a lot of it, we're just scratching the surface. I think that's the other really exciting part. There's, you know, the bioinformatics component to discovery, and then there's the you know, the biochemical reconstitution and putting them into cells or developing diagnostics out of them. So there's a pipeline that we've been working towards from our graduate work, and now bringing that into Mammoth, and that's a core part of the company that really will enable next generation tools, and some of which we're not even, you know, we may not even know what they can enable.
Of course. I mean, it's the old Apple argument, right? You start making computers and you don't realize you're going to go out into music and graphical design and sales,
yeah, exactly,
and services. So I do definitely have a question. As CTO, when people think about technology and they make the allegory to the tech field, to Silicon Valley, you think about holding a device in your hand, a component, a widget, a computer board, a product, et cetera. When you and your team are thinking about this design in the biochemical and life sciences realm, do you usually start from broad or deep? Do you say, hey, we have this one particular nuclease, we know all the things it can do, and we're going to extend it out to its logical use in cold and hot applications and different types of technologies, integrate it with other vendors, et cetera? Or do you go broad and just say, what's all the different things we could do if given X? How do you start?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think in general, we have a philosophy that at some levels, you know, there are discoveries out there that we don't know about. So what we like to do, at least from a scientific standpoint, is cast a large net, but also define very clearly what some product requirements are. So we want to find a nuclease with X activity, or start to narrow down what are the, and you know, what is the business need at the end of the day? Because the CRISPR systems or the CRISPR proteins are what they're going to drive and power the products that we create. And so we like to take the wide net approach and filter through. I mean, there are obviously different models. You can say we want to go after a system that we know works. We want to engineer it to do different things. Totally valid, but we definitely have a philosophy of casting a wide net. As far as the, you know, I think you mentioned, you know, the analogy of having a widget and that being the product. I mean, that's certainly how we think of it as well. I mean, in this case, instead of, you know, in this case, we have biology actually driving the products, right? And so that takes shape in many different formats. Certainly on the diagnostic side, that's one area that we're really excited about as far as where the business can go, because there are multiple product formats for diagnostics, right? You can have anything from a reagent set or analyte specific kit where you mm-hmm. sell the enzymes and buffers and components for others to detect what they want, whether that's in a research use environment or as a, you know, in vitro diagnostic, all the way to developing what we're really excited about and what we believe the next generation of diagnostics is, you know, handheld disposable device that can be deployed in any decentralized environment. And so there's a wide, and then, you know, in between you have centralized laboratories, you have point of care instruments. All of that is powered by, you know, biochemistry at the end of the day. And so this is an exciting area that does require a lot of different people of different backgrounds, you know, all the way from the biology to the engineering. And so we have scientists and engineers as part of our team. And I think that's what makes all of this extremely, you know, enriching as far as how we take, you know, something that is biological, you know, at its core, but use that to enable new avenues.
That's really, really amazing. And to be fair, I cheated a little bit because I've seen your SLAS transformed talk, and I have seen some evidence of the disposable chip and the reagents and the cleavage reagents and the migration of colored bands. And it's really cool stuff. I imagine doing this, you know, with a smartphone or with a really cheap device, especially in emerging economies really soon. So I'm giving you lots of laudits and praise for that. What's the wildest application you see for your technology in the next 5 years? I'm thinking space medicine or deep sea detection or something where you're monitoring background environmental noise. I mean, what is it? What's the wildest thing you might see yourself getting into?
I mean, there are obviously a lot of different things you could do because the system detects, you know, nucleic acid sequences. Basically anything with a DNA or RNA biomarker is a valid target, right, to develop a test around. I think this question was brought up in my SLAS talk as well, but one thing I am personally excited about is this world of host response biomarkers. So not directly detecting the pathogen that may be infecting a host, whether that's human or animal or even plant, but understanding how that host is responding to the particular pathogen and understanding the relative gene expression of the host, I think is an area that's undergoing active research. And there also are very, you know, interesting biomarkers coming out of it. So being able to monitor both the pathogen that's that is infecting the host, as well as understanding how the host is going to respond, I think gives a very cool and exciting and complex profile of better understanding disease manifestation. So I think that's definitely in the future, but the technology has that capability, and I'm excited to leverage that aspect of it.
That's really amazing. And just so you know, you give super amazing answers. You give complex and layered responses, and I do appreciate that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What's the most exciting professional experience you've had? Now, it might be, of course, founding a company, which, you know, you have mentioned about, but is there anything even more exciting than that so far?
Yeah, I mean, I was reflecting on this question because there have been many, but I think the one for me that was very just, you know, one of those moments where you're like in your gut, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like, I'm really onto something, is related to when we had designed the CRISPR system to go after HPV. We managed to collaborate with Joel Pilewski at UCSF, who is an HPV researcher and was very generous and allowed us to basically, you know, prototype our system to on patient samples to identify HPV 16 and 18. So the high risk HPV types for cancer. And I remember distinctly, you know, I ended up taking the plate reader in the Downer lab. I, at the time, you know, didn't have a functioning car. So Ubered across the Bay Bridge with this like microwave
with a plate reader.
Exactly. I think the driver was probably very confused. I was like, don't worry about it.
Like one does, sure.
Yeah, exactly. You know, got to UCSF and set up, had a little setup there and worked with one of the researchers in the lab to work on the patient extracts, and then, you know, set up the test and had it run on the machine that afternoon, collected the results of the detector assay. So that's the name of our detection system. Meanwhile, the researcher was using a predicate assay, a PCR-based assay to confirm the results from the patient samples. But when I was testing it, I was given blinded samples. So I didn't actually know whether or not these results were correct at all. So, you know, packed everything up, went home that evening. And, you know, later that night, I think it was around 10 p.m., Joel had emailed me and said, these results look awesome. And I remember just opening that email and just being like, and, you know, he'd also sent me the results from the PCR assay. And, you know, I saw that it was like almost 100% concordance. I think we missed one or two samples. And at that moment, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is the first time we're actually demonstrating, of course, this is like in a research context, but demonstrating that this system actually will work on patient samples. I think at that moment, I would say I was just so happy and excited. And that really, I think, you know, that is only paralleled and I think rivaled to when we first uncovered this activity from the protein. That's a whole different set of emotions. But this one was really, I think, proving to myself and I think others that this is real, right? And has potential.
Viable technology helps humans. Gotcha.
Exactly.
Okay. What advice do you have for the younger generations who are coming into SLAS now, high school students, college students, grad students, who may want to one day found a startup and may want to, you know, eke out some room in the life sciences? Is there room to be had? What should they be doing? What skills to learn?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think first and foremost, just find good mentors. I've been really fortunate to have people across professional, technical, personal mentors who I've been able to really trust and, you know, be vulnerable and ask for advice when I need it. So I think that's super important. It's not always easy to find good mentors, but when you do, like, hang on to that. I think the other thing too is just in general to be fearless and proactive, like make sure you're always challenging yourself and also have an open mind. I think in doing that, you're going to be able to see new opportunities and I think it's important to seize them. The other part too is, especially in, you know, in technical fields, sometimes, you know, especially, you know, even coming from graduate school, a lot of it you're focused on your project. But I think what's really important to always remember is that teamwork and collaboration is going to be needed to solve kind of the most challenging problems. So while you can be a deep technical expert in one area, I think one thing to always do is to challenge yourself to work with people in other backgrounds, you know, with other skill sets. And then I think one thing that is also very important is to own and learn from your mistakes. And we all make mistakes. I've made many mistakes kind of from, all kinds of
not
mistakes.
Not you. No. You sound amazing. Come
on. And to make sure you learn from them and acknowledge that if it has happened, I think that's really important. As far as, life sciences and what to do, I mean, I truly believe, I'm biased, but I truly believe that this is a time to be in life sciences. I mean, it's really the revolution because there are so many ways that we can program biology. It's so incredibly complex and exciting, and there's so many things to learn that I really encourage people who have a passion in, science and engineering to stick with it. There are definitely going to be challenges, but at the end of the day, if you're following your passions, like you're going to find something that you really love.
I love that. Any closing thoughts? Any ways that SLAS can better help you in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciated the community for reaching out. I had not really connected with SLAS previously, so learning more about the community has been awesome for me. I love being able to tell my story and inspire others that to kind of pave your own path and kind of find ways to work with others. I really appreciate the opportunities that SLAS has given me to talk about the work that the team has been doing and, succeeding at Mammoth and being able to meet new people.
That's really great. And thank you very much for your time. We don't want to hold you up since obviously CRISPR is eating the world and we got to let you get back to it. So thank you very much, Dr. Janice Chen, CTO of Mammoth Biosciences.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, everyone.